Blog Talk Radio.
On this end of the year podcast, yeah, we're concluding 2017. We're kind of looking back. We're reflecting on the year as it ends, our accomplishments, the events that influenced us and shaped our lives. You know, what were the things about 2017 that were inspiring? That's a reflection. We'll head to Mars. We'll speak with an imaging specialist we've had on the program before. What are the new hot spots? What is revealed in 2017? What's really the background behind some of this new archaeology that's been discovered? And what does it mean? What does it mean when NASA says they're sending a manned crew, a manned program to Mars? And today's interview, we have noted astrobiologist Dr. Chandra Wick-Ramsey from England. He'll tell us about his new book, Cosmic Womb, which has been co-written by Robert Bavall. It's on seeding planet Earth and how life begins from extraterrestrial origins. This is something that's completely new. It's been in the news, and we are speaking to the foremost authority on the topic of Earth seeding, the planet Earth's early beginnings, and how this evolves to Homo sapiens sapien. All this and the news today on Earth Ancients. For Saturday, December 30th, 2017, this is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. On this end of the year podcast, we reflect on 2017, what it meant to each of us, you know, our accomplishments, the events that influenced and shaped our lives. You know, what happened? What happened in 2017 that was important to you? How you doing? How are your holidays? I hope you're flowing. We got another one to go. We got New Year's Eve and then New Year's Day. And then we start 2018. So what do you want in 2018? What are you preparing for in the new year? I mean, take time, if you can, to sit by yourself, think about all the stuff that has happened, all the stuff you'd like to have happen in the new year. You know, what's it all about? You know, you're kind of setting the table for the new year when you reflect and then you think about what you want. I mean, I have a big wish list for Earth Ancients in 2018. I mean, I need an intern. I need a new intern. We're launching some new programs. We're going to be announcing some new programs. And I have a new executive producer who I will introduce later in January. But we're expanding, and it's new. We have new guests. We have a diverse program that we're integrating into Earth Ancients. And by the way, if you have a favorite program, I want to hear about it. If you have somebody you think would be a good fit for the program, let me know. Email me at cliff@earthancients.com and let me know what you think would be a good fit for the show. I'm always open to new ideas and new topics. So, but anyhow, it's time to reflect and prepare for 2018. You know, where do you see yourself next year? Is it getting better? Was 2017 horrendous? I know we all have our peaks and valleys, some more challenging than others. And if this has been a challenging year, let's focus on making it a better year in 2018. So I hope you can spend some time. You know, when you think about this, this is, you know, you do kind of a cleansing. And I don't know if you're of the belief of thoughts create reality. Some people think that's a lot of puff, but I have found that it works pretty well for me. So this is a preparing, a preparation for mental, emotional, spiritual happenings, a cleanse, and preparation for the new year. So happy new year. I hope you're ready for 2018. I know I'm excited about some of the things that are coming up, all the changes and all the shifts and fun events that are on the horizon. Earth Ancients is sponsored by Gaia.com. And hey, there's no better New Year's gift than a membership of Gaia. Remember, there's over 7,600 titles on ancient alien, ancient civilizations. We have a number of people on Earth Ancients that are featured on Gaia.com. And there's hundreds of titles on personal growth, everything that you could need or use for preparing for 2018. And it's all for just 99 cents for your first month. You get access to over 7,600 titles and growing. Each week, they release new titles on a variety of subjects. And you can get this by going to Gaia.com/Earth Ancients and just signing up. The second month is about $9.95. But what a great gift. Killer gift. I mean, tons of topics. You can learn how to meditate. You can learn yoga. You can learn Tai Chi. You can hear with the you can hear what the movers and shakers, various topics are all about. Every single month there is new material. Gaia.com/Earth Ancients. Check it out. I think you're gonna like it.
The boys I've known, and I've known some.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
Oh my God, is there some fun stuff in the news this week? Former NASA biochemist Dr. Zehner has created the first DNA enhancer. Now, this is something that I thought would not be available for another 5-10 years, maybe even longer. And this doctor has developed an in-home kit to help you modify and, in some cases, improve the health of your body. It's still in the early phases, but what he's doing is he is presenting gene therapy. And gene therapy to this doctor is you can enhance your body. He is enhancing at this point his strength in the body. His right arm is has been enhanced apparently. He's not getting huge effects, but he is having some strength. And he's the first person on record to edit his own DNA. Now, this article came out in the BBC just a couple of days ago, and I've posted it on the Facebook page. But this is the future. I mean, some people are kind of going, wait, I don't want to do this. And one of the things I was reading, I was looking for this, it's not FDA approved yet, and that might be because he's in England and they don't have the same quality control. But, you know, once the FDA gets onto this and they can certify this, can you imagine? You know, I want to improve my cognition. I want to be able to think clearer. I want to be able to run faster. And now, I don't know what this means, but I was just blown away by this. The first DNA enhancer. You can read it all about it on the Facebook page. Go to Facebook, go to Earth Ancients, and there's a group and an international page, as well as the Earth Ancients website, so check it out. Experts in Turkey claim they have found the remains of a massive ship that could be Noah's Ark. This has been reported in on BBC. Located on Mount Ararat, this structure has remains of wood specimens that they've found. It's up about 13,000 feet in the mountain, and a number of scientists are on this. I think we've reported similar findings by other groups, but this group apparently has found significant wood evidence of trees that are not from the region. And so there's great speculation that this could be the biblical Noah's Ark. Wow, wouldn't that be amazing to find? We have a new gallery. Our friend, Dr. Zahi Hawass. I see that tongue in cheek. There's a number of images from the Giza Plateau. The former director of the Giza Plateau himself, Zahi Hawass, is shown inspecting a number of chambers on the Great Sphinx. Now, these are never before seen images, and I was kind of blown away. There's one image of him actually standing on the back of the Sphinx, looking down at a very perfectly formed cavern. And I've never seen that before. I've seen pictures of him in the front of the Sphinx in a small, what appears to be a cavern, but this is something completely new. So having this available there's so much we don't know about the Giza Plateau because we're not told going on there. So you can see this and lots of other galleries on the Facebook page. And each week we have galleries from around the world submitted. We have articles. We have first run stories that you can see each week on the Facebook page. So check it out, Facebook, Earth Ancients, or the Earth Ancients website. So I want to head to Mars and take a look at some of the latest imaging on the surface provided by NASA, which is JPL, and the European Space Agency. And to get the best images, we need to go to the Mars Revealer, Gary Legere, who is a processing expert. We've had Gary on the program before. But some of the new imaging pieces that he has come up with are fascinating. He's been posting them on his website as well as the Facebook page. So here's a chance to get an update on some of the latest, what I consider archaeology on the face of Mars. So as we complete the year, we want to check on our neighboring planet, the planet Mars. As you all know, I am a big proponent of unknown archaeology. We've had a number of scientists who believe there is the remains of an unknown civilization on Mars, and they've left massively large ruins. Some of them are in the form of faces. And my returning guest this week is the Mars Revealer, Gary Legere, who is just an amazing collector of these anomalous structures. And I wanted to talk a little bit with Gary on some of the better pieces, images that he has found and cleaned up a little bit. I'm going to post a small gallery of Gary's work today so you can see what I'm talking about. But hey, Gary, how you doing, man?
All right, Cliff, hopefully you had a, Merry Christmas and almost a Happy New Year. Hopefully it will be.
Yeah, we got a couple of days, and then we're going to be celebrating the new year. New Year's Eve. But hey, I have to just tell you, I was going through your Facebook page, and man, you got some real dynamite material. This, I mean, you have a couple that you've been posting, and I'm looking at this very first image that you posted on May 16th. Another kind of a face, but before we get into this, can you, without revealing all your tricks of the trade, you actually reprocess these images, don't you, so that they're more clear, they're clearer, they're more detailed, and whatever available light is around them is really brought forward, right?
Well, yes, I process them. I try to process them for the raw as much as possible. But there's other factors at work. It's, you know, it's not something I could easily explain. But what I try to basically do is get through the shades and you know, the darker contrasts and the over brightenings. That's what I call it. And I try to dissipate all that to get in the reveal, again, like you said, the detail, the relief of the features itself, so we can see more of what we're looking at. I'm real happy with Mars Express imagery, though it's lower res than, let's say, MRO. It's like Odyssey quality, maybe a little better of res. But what they show on Mars Express's image data, they seem to be able to bring out more of the tattoo work, in my opinion. That's what I call it, like a tattoo artist gone mad. That allows us to see features that we don't readily see in NASA imagery, though. Once you see these and compare them, then you can find them better in NASA imagery. So I was talking about this last night about whatever it is they're using on that craft, we should be using it, and we probably are. We're just not getting that data like they have. I guess, you know, maybe it's contracts because different nations, different missions, but they all signed under the NASA policy. You know, so, you know, we'll give you this, we'll give you that. But, you know, you can only go so far because it's a planned acclimation, and that's what it is about these structures on there. Is it all ruins? I don't believe all that, but it's possible. A lot of them do look like they've seen better days, don't they, Cliff?
Well, I mean, we've had Dr. Brandenburg on the show and Mark Carlotto and a number of people who – were some of the original image processing team. And, you know, yeah, some of these images are apparently thousands of years old. Brandenburg likes to consider them in the millions, in some cases.
That's possible, too.
If you consider those timelines, the degradation, the damage, the erosion to, say, a man-made structure that's a mile long by half a mile long across.
Or larger.
Or significantly larger. Could, I mean, it's going to begin to fall apart. And this is what's so unique about what I found on your Facebook page, Gary, is not one or two faces. You got tons of faces that I think, I mean, they're just wonderful. And it's funny that we don't hear about these other potentials.
Well, that's because I brought this up last night too. It's about policy. It's about what they will openly say compared to, all right, just throw the data out, but we're not going to say anything about it. You know, we're not going to tell the people, you know, we're looking for drip, drip, drip. The policy is nothing is artificial in the sense made by intelligence. They cannot say that. You know, they will not until the time is right. Now, but in the other hand, how do you get the data out to the public? Well, just giving it to the public. If they're asked questions about it, you're putting a realm of Bigfoot and Loch Ness Monster by that policy. But yet, we still have the data, which speaks for itself. Pun intended, isn't it?
I want to ask you a question. And by the way, those of you listening, Gary's gallery will be on the Facebook page by the end of Saturday, which is today. And also automatically uploaded to earthancients.com. Gary, one of the things that is quite unique in the clarified images that you post here is the appearance of what looks like lines around the perimeter, which could be some form of mechanical vehicle or a device that was used to create these either heads or sculptural reliefs. Have you kind of come with a conclusion on these lines that are around the perimeter, that they look like agricultural field lines, but they're actually, I think, some of the early or what's remaining from the creators of these sculptures?
No, that's the thing. What do you mean, like the lines, like the how it stands out? What do you mean?
If you look at, let's take a look here. Let me see if I can find one. It is the rounded head. Let's see. You posted it about a month ago. It's an oval head with clear eyes, a bit of a nose, and not much of a mouth left. Maybe the upper lip. It's got a small crater on the top of his lip. But around the outer left side is what appears to be these strange lines, which if you look
at the shiny forehead, with the shiny forehead, the one with the shiny forehead.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, gotcha. And there's a crater under the left, less like the face of Cydonia by coincidence.
Exactly.
Crater down below it. Okay. I see where you're going. In my opinion, this thing sits on an artscape to where its tattoo goes and shapes this face. It goes over it. It all interacts with each other. And every imagery from Mars Express to NASA, I mean, if you get MRO, it'll look, you'll say, oh, well, those are sand dunes. Those are sand dunes. Well, wow. You know, it's funny these sand dunes don't move, but they look pretty solid. They look pretty relieved. I mean, you know, and it's just like a tattoo artist gone mad. If you think like of a spider web, a picture spider web within a spider web and a spider web that shows all different art. This, you know, then you could get the concept, but then you're being overwhelmed by the obvious answer. If that's being done, is intelligence behind it? And that's the big thing. That's the big Martian revelation, you know, because we are not the most superior things, and humanity has to adapt in order for us to go out to space and be able to go to Mars without people having heart attacks. They have to be informed first, you know, and therefore, to adapt for us to go out there, we have to be able to take in these features and acknowledge them because they are real, you know, like it or not, they're real. We're finding things on this earth that's buried that's just as huge, you know, like Bosnia, the pyramid region. That whole region is like this face. It's been sculpted. It's been made. It's been shaped. Even the Fornicia River and all the regions around there. But it's hard to see unless you take away all the subsurface crud that's been deposited over time. Who knows how many really is? Who knows how old really those pyramids are? Just because, you know, we got some composition. I think you have guests on your show before that talked about that regards to the dating of you know, any organic materials in around the Bosnian pyramid area. Oh, it's more than 12,000 years. Well, that doesn't mean the pyramid was built then. It means it was there then when this organic material fell there. You know, so it could have been around hundreds of thousands of years for all we really know, because like Jock Doubleday pointed out, they used all these, that the material was, well, we say man-made, we'll say artificially, intelligently made, and not just for a mountain-sized pyramid, but for an entire hemisphere where other pyramids reside. That's, I call that artscaping.
Right.
It's a massive scale. So what we're seeing there is like a fresh imprint of what we might expect here if we took the subsurface away for miles on end and looked at it and say, wow, in my opinion. I haven't done that, but by what I'm seeing, you know, it certainly fits the shoe. And if it's not impossible here on Earth, thanks to Mr. Osmanovic and Chalk Doubleday's, you know, and others' findings, regards to this, it is not far-fetched at all what we're seeing on Mars. It's just another planet is the spooky factor for people, which falls back to Brookings.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
as we go into the new year, Gary, what are your goals in your continual research?
To get to the truth.
Yeah.
To get to the truth and hopefully have this disclosure. And I believe that disclosure is already starting to take place. As you know, Cliff, the Pentagon recently came out with a big news story themselves that they basically disclosure. They've been following UFOs for some time up to 2012. I'm sure they're still doing it. As well as Mr. Mike Pence. Remember, I forget what date, but it was Cape Canaveral where he said, we're going to send American boots and land. We're going to send American boots and land on the face of Mars. That was his exact words. Isn't that something? So, and if we look at that, Cliff and others, in like a form of disclosure, not only is he saying we're going to send American boots, you think it's just me and astronauts? American boots is a term, soldiers, to the face of Mars. So he's saying we're going to send soldiers out there. And he's acknowledging the disclosure, the face of Mars is real. Because how could you send American boots to land and walk on the face of Mars? And on the surface, people are like, oh, he just means the surface. Well, no, I think it's more, again, in this disclosure aspect, he said it point clear. How can you argue with it? On the face of Mars, people would think the face of Cydonia. Oh, my gosh. Or am I mistaken? Yeah. What would you think, Cliff?
I don't know. I all I know is that I would sure like NASA to come clean with this revelation and quit talking about microbes and water and ice and really start showing the remains of these structures and up close and personal. So, but
they do show them. Like I said before, they're not talking about them. We're the ones that have to create the discussion to make it happen. But go ahead.
Yeah. Hey, Gary, much continued success on your great material. For those of you listening, you can go to Facebook, go to Mars Revealer, R-E-V-E-A-L-E-R. Gary is very, very active on his Facebook page and is constantly updating and promoting. Do you have? I can't remember. You have a website, too. You want to give that URL to people?
Yes, www.thefacesofmars.com.
Hey, let's have you, let's do a full show with you in February, okay?
Sounds good, my friend.
So I'll be in contact with you. We'll do a show on your research, and we'll do an hour of content with some of the latest findings that you have, okay, man?
Excellent. Thank you, Cliff, and Happy New Year, and may the Martian revelation begin.
Happy New Year, Gary, and we'll be in
Happy
touch.
New Year.
Today's interview is brought to you by Vital Transport. Vital Transport is the official travel agency of Earth Ancients, and our upcoming tour of Guatemala called Secrets of Guatemala is June 15th through the 24th. This is an unprecedented opportunity to see some of the details from an archaeological point of view of the Maya culture. This is going to be a 9-day personal private view of some of the most compelling ruins that you'll ever visit. We're going to be going to Copan, Cuirlagua. We're going to go to Tikal. We're going to go to a smaller cities in between those major places. Each location is filled with some of the most detailed artifacts, buildings, pyramids. And as always, what we do on these tours is we engage with the buildings. That means we're going to climb the pyramids. I have a special program where when we're at Tikal, we will go to the World Pyramid where John Burke did his famous testing. And we'll actually get there in time to actually feel the energy pulsating up from the pyramid into the atmosphere. And of course, those of us who are standing on the top of that pyramid will feel this energy. Again, the dates are June 15th through the 24th, 2018. For more information, go to earthancients.com/tours, and you'll see Secrets of Guatemala. The full itinerary was there. Pretty much everything is covered. We've made it very, very reasonable. All you need to do is get yourself out there. Again, it's earthancients.com/tours.
seems like each year there's new revelations about how the Earth was populated, how the hominins, who are ancestors, have come to be. And I just thought it was important that we bring on experts to talk about the seeding of Earth, this new revelation that beings, the plant life, the animal life, is from off-world resources. And today my guest is the foremost authority on astrobiology, Dr. Chandra Wickramses, who has written a new book with co-host Robert Bavall. So I think you're really going to enjoy this interview. So it's a great pleasure for me to introduce my guest today. He is one of the foremost scientists in the field of astrobiology. He is actually the director of the Center for Astrobiology at the University of Buckingham, a professor of applied mathematics and astronomy. He has taught at the University of College of Cardiff, at the University of Cambridge, and he is the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Astrobiology and Outreach, and he actually lives in Cardiff, Wales. This book we're talking about today was co-authored by Robert Bavall, and it's called Cosmic Womb, the Seeding of Planet Earth. Professor Wickramses, it's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Yeah, nice talking to you. Right, great. Yes.
Tell me a little bit about how you got together with Robert Bavall, who is a somewhat of a regular on our program, who is an engineer who has spoken and written quite extensively about the Great Pyramids in Giza, Egypt.
Well, the pyramids have always fascinated me, and I happened to see the pyramids before all the great big buildings were built around the area where the pyramids stand at the moment. The pyramids are just an amazing feat of human endeavor. And ever since I first saw the pyramids, the question of why they were built and what is their purpose and so on absolutely fascinated me. And what intrigued me about Bavall's thesis was the proposed alignment of the three pyramids, the three Giza pyramids, with the main stars of the Orion belt. There are three stars that you can see in the belt of Orion, mm-hmm. and it's an almost exact mapping of the Orion stars, and this sort of intrigued me. It's intrigued other people. Astronomers have taken it seriously, argued whether this is a real coincidence or whether it is just a fortuitous coincidence and so on. So this was the reason that I became really interested talking to Bavall. At the time, also, I considered I was working with, as you said, with the late Sir Fred Hoyle and a couple of other people on the role that comets played in molding civilization, in sort of essentially directing the progress of civilization. We have ample evidence now that comet impacts have played a role. They played a physical role, in fact, in sort of causing, creating craters and sort of extinction of the dinosaurs was caused by a comet impact. The end of the last ice age appears to have been modulated at the very least by a few impacts of fragments of comets. And these impacts didn't stop at 10,000, 11,000 BC. They continued with in time intervals of about 3,000 or 4,000 years in between. And coming back to the pyramids, it happened that the building of the Great Pyramids at, what is it, about 2,500 BC, mm-hmm. appeared to coincide with one of these collision events. And so if one was living, an advanced civilization was living at the time, what would they do? They would try to watch the skies and see where these fragments that sort of striking the Earth might be coming from. It's like a meteor shower. Meteor showers appear to originate in at one point in the sky, right? The Perseids, for instance, in from a point in Perseids. Mm-hmm. So what the I thought what the pyramids did was to produce was to offer. They were not just tombs for pharaohs. I think that's a crazy idea that archaeologists have had. That's not by that's not anything like what the pyramids were built for. They were built to A, to show the absolute superiority of a civilization. B, the timing of the pyramid, building of the pyramids, I think indicated to me that this was a period of ferocious impacts from the skies, coming from seemingly from one point in the sky, and they had to keep a watch on that point. And the pyramids have these huge, what are they called, channels from the king's chamber. The main pyramid has a channel that goes out, points to a particular point in the sky. Right. So, I mean, it may be a fanciful idea, but I had the idea that these the astronomers amongst the ancient pyramid builders were sort of couched up in the king's chamber.
I do have to ask you, though, that in his book, The Orion Mystery, Bouval highlights the fact that his belief is that the pyramids were probably built around 10,000 years ago based on these alignments, these Orion belt alignments. And I'm just curious about your feeling, because traditional Egyptologists believe that the pyramid was built by Khufu, a pharaoh who lived approximately 2,500 BC. And Bouval believes that the Great Pyramid and most of the complex was built much, much earlier.
Well, I think I'm aware of Bouval's argument for this. I'm not convinced by that. And I think I would tend to veer in the direction of the conventional archaeologists in thinking that it was the later period. But I might be wrong. I don't know whether that the evidence really holds up. Archaeological evidence is still thin for the older origin of the pyramids, whereas for the from many, many different points of view, from the pyramid texts, from Egyptology and so on, some of my colleagues sort of would firmly assert that it was built around 2500 or thereabouts BC. Mm-hmm. So I think let's keep an open mind on this. And I mean, Robert and I didn't agree 100% on the content of the book, and that's why we have it in two parts.
Yeah, no, you know, it's a fun book to read, and I got quite an education reading your background and your research, not only with Professor Hoyle, but also what you discovered. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about what you have discovered and what the research in astrobiology has come up with, specifically these bombardments. And the general belief in science now is that meteorites bombarded the Earth, brought biological life to Earth around 4.1 billion years ago. Can you talk a little bit about the formation, what the Earth was like at that time, and how these biological life forms were embedded in, I guess, the Earth?
Yeah, well, the Earth was formed around 4,500. I mean, this is the conventional picture, which I don't disagree with. It was formed about 4.5 billion years ago from rocky fragments like asteroids. A huge swarm of these asteroids were orbiting the sun and where the Earth is now, and these were in collision with one another, and the collisions ended up with a single object of huge of Earth mass, Earth size, and this happened maybe 4.4 billion years ago or thereabouts, and then because of its gravity, it became more and more spherical, but the early stages of this process of the formation of the Earth was a very hot process. For maybe a fraction of a billion years, perhaps a full billion years, the Earth was just sort of a smoldering sort of lava field almost. Mm-hmm. And in spite of that, during that time when the Earth was still cooling from the impact events that essentially made it, there were comets, much cooler, colder objects from the far outer regions of the solar system impacting the cooling Earth. And we have good evidence for that. And so it was during that 4.2 billion years ago period that the very first evidence of life has now been discovered. This is only a discovery that is maybe a few years old now. Mm-hmm. And it's a very secure discovery that the oldest life, which is essentially bacteria or sort of charred bacteria, burnt bacteria, embedded in rocks, bits of rock, have been discovered in Australia and in Canada, the two sites that have been studied. And so there's no question that bacterial life came to the Earth very, very quickly, very, very soon after the Earth itself had formed.
Okay.
There was no time left. I mean, the conventional wisdom is, I think, I can't imagine that human beings, intelligent scientists, had gone along with the belief that spontaneous generation of life took place, right? Mm. This is a belief that's very ancient in terms of its history. It goes back to Aristotle, the great philosopher in the 4th century BC, who said that life emerges whenever you mix warm earth and morning dew or something like that. And Aristotle was a very powerful figure in philosophy right through the ages.
Right.
And for that reason, this idea just held sway for pretty close to the present time in various forms, despite evidence against it. But I think what happened was that bacteria came, and in the form of bacteria, the information that came with the bacteria is just absolutely enormous. Bacteria are not simple structures. Amino acids right. and the organic molecules are simple structures. But in terms of information, a single bacterium is probably worth all the computers in Texas or something in terms of its information storage. So right. they're huge informational units, even a single bacterium. And the question is, where did it arise? It could not have arisen in the primordial soup. There was no primordial soup, for one thing, because we know it's the Earth was essentially boiling hot at the time. That sort of completely rules it out, in my view.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people still try to say that maybe in the deep ocean, in the deeper down, there were cooler places where there was water, and some all kinds of intellectual gymnastics are still being tried out, but I think it's a lot.
I love that term. That's very good. Intellectual gymnastics. Yeah, but I mean, is it the general belief of science of you and your group that some form of a humanoid being was created from these early spores, how do we progress from meteorites bombarding the Earth, implanting these biological life forms, and then what's the progression? Is it the belief that that man is developed at some point, or what is the thinking?
Well, I think my point of view is that the human man, Homo sapiens, and in fact, every living creature on the Earth could not have evolved through Darwinian processes on the Earth. The information to make a man was already there in the form of sort of scores and maybe millions of virus particles. They were floating around, and they came to the Earth at different times. Let me give you an example of how the standard picture of life and humans arising by pure random processes is just ludicrous, right?
Right.
We talked about the first bacteria coming to the Earth or appearing on the Earth 4.1 billion years ago.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
If the standard story is correct, these bacteria then start reproducing, so copying their genomes, and occasionally there's a mistake in the copying error. if the cropping era turns out to be favorable to the environment, then that is passed on to the next generation. And so so a succession of cropping eras is supposed to lead to new and wonderful life forms, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, take that thesis and look at what the evidence shows you. For 2 billion years, bacteria remain bacteria. Okay, nothing happens. It's all bacteria right through the geological record up to the point about 2 billion years ago, right, when more complex cells appear, which are called eukaryotes, like the cells in our own bodies or the cells in a mosquito.
Mm-hmm.
They arise. They have nuclei. They have much more interesting internal structures than a bacterium. And they arise very suddenly. Then another couple of billion years have to lapse. You just have bacteria and these eukaryotes, single-celled life. Until then, they copy themselves, they make errors. Nothing happens for another 2 billion years until there's a huge explosion of multicelled life, which are essentially all the small plants and animals. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And then we have another explosion of mammals happening later, and then the germline that we belong to appears again suddenly, and even in the development of human intelligence, Homo sapiens sapiens, as we like to call ourselves, wise guys like us from Texas or California, right?
Right.
We arose. Also very suddenly, because there's a whole bunch of genes that suddenly get implanted in our genomes. We know that from the gene sequencing that has been done recently, and they're called the FOXP genes. And this happened maybe 50,000 years ago, very recently. And then that led to development of speech and so on, and increased brain size. So all of the architecture that made up humans, I think I think humans are a synthesis of alien genes. I don't necessarily think that our ancestors came down in spaceships. They may have done so, but the evidence is not.
I want to stop you right there, because you bring up right there the off-world thinking in your book, and this is something that is fascinating to me. Now, you make a very important point by saying the process of meteorite and space dust bombarding Earth does not stop. It's a never-ending process. And so my question to you is, if many billions of years ago there was the rudimentary cellular life form on the Earth, would the continual bombardment add to the growth of the cellular levels to create a human, create an animal, create a plant life in some form or another? And the second question to that would be, is there intelligent life, an intelligent plan in place that is sending this data, this micro form of cellular life to the planet Earth?
I think the latter is what I would favor. The first possible explanation, that just the bringing in of these new bits and pieces in a sort of blind fashion would produce all of the marvelous developments, like the sudden emergence of mammals and so on. I don't see how that can be done. I think the point is that my thinking is going in the direction of saying that all the developments of life that we enjoy and admire, they were already predestined. They could not have happened in a small place like the Earth. The Earth is, after all, a speck of dust in the cosmic context, whereas you have all these highly informational cells everywhere. As far as we can see in the universe, they're everywhere. And so one needs the entire size of the universe, a huge volume of space in the universe, maybe almost an infinite time interval in which all of these marvelous, beautiful, wonderful living arrangements can be come together. They could not have come together in a trivial, small environment like the Earth. So, I mean, there's a kind of predestiny. There's a kind of maybe even a kind of creationism involved. But it's an abstract creationism that is derived from the sheer size and the age and the enormous scope that the universe offers in order to produce biological evolution. Biological evolution on the Earth was just a minor. I mean, Darwinian evolution happens, but it's just for fine-tuning that it happens.
I get the feeling, though, that from your research and from your discoveries, that on some level, although you don't speak about this directly, there is intelligent design. There's an intelligent design in these bombardments that might be random. It might be that some extremely advanced culture, civilization somewhere light years away from Earth is directing this to seed planets, wouldn't you say?
I think so. I mean, I think intelligent design has got a bad name for reasons that are entirely sociological. I think scientists have dreaded the thought of intelligent design because they think it is going back to early sort of Christian dogma. I mean, I don't see anything wrong in Christian dogma per se, but there was a social revolution, a sort of societal revolution that elected maybe about 50, 60, 70 years ago to decide, they decided that this is wrong. I think the literal truth of the Bible or of any religious text has to be questioned because these are all of them, even the Bible, I think, and all these religious texts are human constructs, right? Humans have interpreted something in the universe that was told to them by their religious prophets who had maybe an inspired vision of what the world is like. I mean, there's nothing bad about that because even the ancient philosophers like Democritus and so on, they had ideas about atoms. I mean, they didn't have experiments that they did and discover the nature of atoms, but they had the sort of intuition that there were certain aspects of the universe that was there and had to be taken for granted. So in a similar way, all religions argue, including Christianity, that there is an inherent design in the nature of, certainly in the nature of higher life, nature of our type of life. And personally, I don't have anything against that. I think it is not inconsistent with any facts. The reason that we tend as a society, as a scientific society, to reject these ideas are entirely sociological. Mm-hmm. I think there's nothing more than sociology that is turning people away from that. Okay. And that's my position. I think intelligent design, as it is presented as a religious thing, is not something that I would go for. But there is an intelligence inherent in the universe. Maybe it was a silicon-based life that dominated some point in the universe's history, and maybe the silicon-based life created. Deliberately created the life that we see around us, a carbon-based life. That's one possibility.
I want to veer off a little bit and talk about some of the findings that you and Hoyle have come across that I don't think most of us today understand. And this is the idea and your hypothesis, and I don't know if it's gone beyond a hypothesis to actual constructs, but that is that the Earth is continually being bombarded by these viruses and bacteria. And strangely enough, you believe and have formulated a lot of thought that a number of influenzas, the common cold, other illnesses are space-borne. And my question to you is, what does the medical scientific community feel about that? Because I, when I read that, I was just blindsided at the possibilities of being, you know, bombarded by these spores and these bacteria that could be a problem, could be pathogens that are damaging to the human body.
Well, I think that there's absolutely no evidence in my own thinking that this is happening. The evidence from epidemiology, from the studies, for instance, of influenza, the sudden appearance of a new strain of influenza, there are ways in which people are trying to explain it in terms of random mutations, in terms of hybrid forms of pig virus and bird virus and so on. None of these things have explained the features of epidemics, right? For instance, in 1918-1919, which is the most devastating flu pandemic in recorded history, where I think some 3 or 4 million people died throughout the world, the first appearance of the new strain that caused this was on the same day in Boston and Bombay, in Mumbai, India, right? And these were not days where there were not space, there were no aircraft or any spacecraft or satellites around the Earth, and even cross winds would not have taken anything across from Boston to Mumbai or Mumbai to Boston in less than days. So to have it happen immediately, this is one instance, but there are many, many other instances that cannot be explained by the conventional wisdom. For example, take what's happening now. Three or four years ago, the Zika virus reappeared. I mean, Zika has been a virus that was endemic, and it's been around for a few years. We know that it's in monkeys, and there's been the idea that it started in monkeys and hopped over to humans and so on. That may or may not be true, but what happened recently was that the Zika virus suddenly acquired a new bit of gene, a new bit of genetic material that made it a totally different beast, right? Yeah. This is the virus that causes microcephaly, it's called.
Yes, the small brain.
Yeah, small brain with diminished cognitive ability, right?
Yeah.
And the alarming thing about it, I think, where did it come from? I think it may have come, I mean, there's conventional wisdom that it was a mutation. It has not been proved to be a mutation. More likely, it was one of these things that you've been talking about, the bits of viruses that are just continuing to come through the atmosphere and latch on to existing genomes, existing cells, viruses, and so on. So I think that's what happened. But I think the alarming thing about Zika is that it's producing this microcephaly, diminished cognitive abilities, and it's also sexually transmitted. That's scary, because it means that, in principle, the whole world could be turned into subhuman creatures. So yeah. it's a backward step in human evolution. I told you that the FOXP genes came in at some early point in our evolution and made us wiser guys, right?
They were able to speak
and write books and so on. So this may be a reverse. But you're right. The medical pundits and the centers for disease control should take this hypothesis seriously. You know, my belief is that this is happening, but it's a covert operation because people are not, I think the authorities are not really of a mind to make the public scared and so on. So I think it's probably a surveillance is taking place, but it's not, we don't know much about it. That's my private belief. And
yeah.
Maybe I tell you a story. I don't know. I've written it in this book, but one of the great guys that I knew in my life was Arthur C. Clarke. Arthur C. Clarke was a great science fiction writer,
of course,
a great prophet, isn't it? Prophet of science and futures. And he was a great fan of these ideas. I mean, obviously, he had to be. He believed in aliens, intelligent aliens, alien life, and so he was one of my greatest supporters. And I used to see him very frequently. As your listeners know, I was born in Sri Lanka. Arthur lived in Sri Lanka for most of his life. Mm. And so I used to visit him in his house, and we had long, long, long discussions on various matters. And on one visit in 1982, we had just written two books, Diseases from Space and Evolution from Space. Mm. And Arthur had these books on his bookshelf. And he told me a really almost fantastic story. He said, the other day, I had a visit from Mr. X. I shouldn't really give the name of the person or the station. He's a very high up in the U.S. intelligence, right? Anybody who came past Sri Lanka tended to stop over in Colombo and see this great Arthur C. Clarke, right? So this guy, Mr. X, also did so and sat in his study, and then his eyes roamed around his bookshelf and said, apparently went up to the bookshelf, pulled out the book Diseases from Space, and flipped through the pages and said, you know, Arthur, you know that we are aware of all of this, right?
Wow, yeah.
Around 1982, 1983, I had sort of set it aside in my mind. I hadn't thought much about it, but now when I have tweets and various messages saying that these things are being looked into, I just wonder whether it's true. There's evidence. I mean, do we know that, do your listeners know that 3 years ago, 2015, Russian cosmonauts, in a routine cleaning operation of the International Space Station, found organisms deposited on the outside of the window. They were not brought up from the Earth. It was between two cleaning operations. They found a sort of blob of biological stuff with living cells on the window. They made an announcement. They have published one paper, a very cautious paper, in a Russian journal. No English language journal has accepted the paper for some reason. Saying that these are coming from comets, that the comets are carrying these materials and they're slapping onto the face of the International Space Station, which is at 400 kilometers, right? Mm-hmm. It's 400 miles. Anyways, it's a huge height above the Earth, no way in which anything can be lofted from the Earth in sort of air currents or anything. So there's been evidence like that. There's evidence that some creatures like what I call tardigrades, water bears, have been taken up to the space station, brought back, and they have survived. Seeds have been taken up there, brought back, and survived, and so on. So every bit of evidence, big and small, supports the thesis that life is a truly cosmic phenomenon. We are just a building site here on the Earth for putting together to assembling all these life forms. And I think that's going to be the major revolution of the next generation. We've got to accept that we are essentially the ancient earthlings, are bacteria, viruses, and the components of our genes that make us what we are.
Let me go back a minute real quickly and just ask you to, I mean, when we talk about DNA, it's a very complex arrangement, right?
Yeah.
And it's just hard for me, and I'm not a scientist, to imagine that a human being, a Homo sapiens sapien, can be created from early bacterium. Doesn't it make more sense that, and I'm just going to ask you this again, and I think you may have answered it, but maybe you can clarify, and that is, if there's intelligent design and the Earth is bombarded by different types of cellular microns or micros. That's not the right word. But anyhow, there are multiple layers of these come to Earth and overlap and begin to connect. And then at some point, DNA is created. Isn't that would make more sense to me than just randomly throwing out cells to a planet and then it turning into Homo sapiens sapien. I mean, that's where the intelligent design, to my mind, comes into play, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I agree with you. I think that slapping on the earth just random bacteria, we can do that until the cows come home, until the stars die out. Nothing would happen. It has to have been, I wouldn't say preordained, but the arrangements of DNA that make you and me and pigs and cows and so on, they had to have been in place long before the earth was formed. And it had. I think the intelligent design argument has a lot going for it.
Okay.
If only we can separate the intelligent design from any sort of limited religious perspective. I think that's what seems to be killing it in terms of acceptance. I mean, we are the design of the structure of a human being, the structure of a flowering plant and so on, is not a random throwing together of junk. There's absolutely no way in which that could have that we could see it that way. I think there is a consciousness, a cosmic consciousness, a cosmic intelligence that underlies the whole of higher life, certainly, and maybe even lower life forms are also included in that. So yes, I agree with you that random processes like just throwing together stuff is almost as primitive, as almost as flawed as the early Aristotelian idea that if you just stir a bit of warm earth and morning dew, you can get anything like snakes or butterflies or anything like that.
Okay.
So I think it's as crazy as that.
So I want to ask you, you bring up Francis Crick and Leslie Orgel's theory. They call it directed panspermia, which, and of course, they were the discoverers of the DNA double helix. Can you define that, the directed panspermia, what that means and why that is such a radical thought that most people don't understand?
And most people reject it because I think it then harps back to the idea of intelligent design or design.
Exactly. Yes.
But I think you cannot dispute that Crick was one of the greatest scientists of the last century, and he unlocked our DNA, the nature of life in form of DNA and so on. And he, having thought about the origins of life and the complexity of life for a long time, for decades, decided that it cannot be just a random process, that somebody, some super intelligent agent, had to put the DNA together and throw it into various places like the earth. And we were just, as I said earlier, a receiving station for already pre-arranged, pre-evolved structures like these viruses that Crick has been talking about. So that's I think that the convergence between Crick's point of view, directed panspermia, and what I have been talking about in the last few minutes is really quite astounding.
Yeah, I mean it's pretty radical. I mean he's basically saying in his theory is that an advanced ET race of some kind. I mean he doesn't say that, or maybe he does. Does he use that terminology?
He doesn't use this terminology, but it's implied. It's implied because this is a time when he wrote that at the time when I think it was about the time that SETI was starting, isn't it? And these guys in the United States and NASA was involved in it at the outset, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. So it was all over the news at the time. And so the idea that there is extraterrestrial intelligence and super intelligence exceeding that of humans was around at the time and being discussed. So I think he was inspired. He was directed by that kind of activity that was happening outside of generally in science. There's no doubt that he regards the construction of complex life viruses being far too complex, far, far too complex to have been just randomly, far too complex in a very specific sense, right?
Right.
I mean, if you look at patterns of clouds on any cloudy day in the sky, those are very complex patterns, but those patterns mean nothing, isn't it? One complex pattern is exactly. as good as yeah. another. But the complexity of life, of human life, of life of any kind, is so specific in its complexity. So its specific complexity that he's talking about is so super astronomical
yes.
that an agent, intelligent agent, is required. And so we have taken up that in our writings, Fred and me, I think a year or two before Crick, we wrote about in our book, Evolution from Space. We had a chapter with the title Convergence to God, ? Right?
Mm-hmm.
And what we had there is that if you can imagine the universe is arising some distant time with no life and no intelligence, and that intelligence first arose in a silicon-based life form, right? Mm-hmm. Supreme intelligence arose, and that intelligence decided to design the whole sort of gamut of life, biological carbon-based life that we see on the Earth. You cannot, that argument cannot be ruled out, absolutely, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have the possibility that, for instance, now we make robots, right? We're talking a lot about robots taking over our jobs and so on. And so if you give another, maybe 100 years from now, robots would perhaps be intelligent robots. And if the intelligent robot decides, gets free will and decides to do some biological engineering, they might be able to make creatures in the form of little bacteria and so on, and throw it out into space. And that would be directed panspermia, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. I didn't even think about that. You know, in your book, you actually show images of these bacteria, and a lot of them are very sophisticated looking. And it's like we're looking at alien microbes. And it's amazing to see these in the bodies of these meteorites. It's just fascinating. When you show these to other scientists, are they surprised? Are they alarmed? What's the reaction?
Well, if the scientists are not involved in meteorite studies, they are impressed, and they would take it at face value. And they would say that these are very interesting discoveries. They need to be examined further. And using all our resources, we should really study them and find out what they are. But I think what is really astounding at the present moment is that science is essentially, progress of science is being strangled by ultra-conservatism, right? If you discover something like these structures in meteorites that apparently go against the reigning paradigm that life started on the Earth, then you'd have a hard time getting money to do the most sophisticated experiments that are needed to establish these ideas. So that's where we are at the moment. We have meteorites, and my colleagues and I have sent balloons to the stratosphere. We brought down structures, bits and pieces that are coming from space that look like biology. We have done the tests that are inexpensive and can be supported by sort of private individuals on cheap rates. But when it comes to utilizing the resources of big laboratories and big governments, they don't want to know about it, because the belief is that no life could come from outside.
Wow, that's amazing to hear that. I mean, it's somewhat sad, and you're saying this is a worldwide phenomena. It's not just the United States.
Not just the United States. United States, I think, is part of a Western consortium to block the truth about the nature of life from the general public, at least.
Oh my God!
And I don't know. I can't understand the rationale or the logic for it. but it is there. I think the opening would come from India and China and Japan. They are more open. They are more open to new ideas, more open to radical ideas and so on. So I think that's I see hopeful signs. I mean, we may not like the politics of China, we may not like the politics of India, but the science is just astounding. What's happening in those countries is just absolutely, you got to go to those countries to see what's happening. So I think the major breakthroughs hopefully will come in the not too distant future and would establish our truly cosmic ancestry and our truly cosmic origins, which we in the West are really afraid to even probe to the point of proving it. I think we are probably in the Middle Ages or so thereabouts in terms of scientific attitude.
So what you're basically saying is that when you publish a paper or a peer-reviewed paper, or you speak and lecture among your peers in the Western scientific community, there's more resistance, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. There's resistance to the point of saying that, oh, these are interesting ideas and we think that it's worth probing them. But when it comes to getting funding for doing the further experiments, we are just rejected. The peer review process is a process of essentially censorship. The anonymous peer reviews are anonymous. Mm-hmm. If you want to get money for a new project or get a paper into Nature. I mean, I have lots of papers that I've published in Nature. I think more papers than an average scientist would have had in Nature in a lifetime, about 60 or 70 papers. Wow. But after we came to the conclusion that life was being delivered from outside, we had great difficulty in getting our papers published in the mainstream peer-reviewed journals. We have got a trickle through the peer-reviewed journals, but most of them we have to have publications in open access journals and so on. So there is a huge censorship in operation, and a censorship that would be to the detriment of progress and of the future of our species.
I'm not surprised because we have a lot of scientists on this program who follow a lot of the ancient Egyptian, Maya, Chinese theories, and the older cultures seem to be more open to a lot of this possibility about life coming from extraterrestrial sources. Can you talk a little bit about that, especially in the Hindu Vedas, some of this information being pretty plain, pretty delivered fairly directly, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, I think the Vedas would make a categorical statement that we came from the stars, that we came from the skies. And the fact that all their gods and goddesses are essentially residing in the heavens, to me, implies that this is a sort of figurative way of saying that we are creatures of the cosmos. And the transition from that to a godhead that was essentially earth-based and had a connection with the cosmos, but only a sort of a rather distant connection, led to the rejection of the older ideas. The older ideas are considered primitive and savage and so on. But when you think about it, then the whole of Indian culture is crucial to the has been crucial to the progress of science, isn't it? I mean, the number system, our counting system, we wouldn't be able to do our calculations or science without the number zero, the concept of the number zero. And that was an Indian concept that was introduced via the Arabs to Western science. And now I think we know that the Mayans and the Babylonians and so on had very similar intuitions about the connection with the cosmos. They were, I think, the ancient culture, I wouldn't say primitive, the older cultures of the world, the older civilizations, had a built-in acceptance of our cosmic origins. And later science, European science, has continued to reject that with no basis in terms of fact or evidence.
Hmm. That's fascinating. Let's we're coming down to our final few minutes here. I want you to, if you can, project into the future. What would be your best case scenario for not only accepting your hypothesis that we are a seeded planet, but I mean, say in the next 5 or 10 years, would you like to see contact with an ET race? I mean, what would be a real satisfying event for you to clarify your research?
Well, contact with a super intelligent race would be fantastic if that happens.
Yeah.
I think we are not searching hard enough. There's been a revival of the SETI program through endeavors of the, was it a Russian billionaire and Stephen Hawking?
Yeah, I read about that, yes.
They've been promoting it. So there's been a revival of that. You would recall that NASA, who started that in the 1950s, early 1960s, essentially refused to support it any further. And it was SETI was supported by private organizations ever since. So there's not been much funding that went into the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. So I think that if that is reversed, if there's a lot of funding put into it, maybe we will get a result. And that would be exciting to hear our first sophisticated hello from space.
Yeah.
That would be one thing. But I mean, the other thing is that the scientists should consider seriously the possibility that life is coming in all the time, that viruses and so on are coming in almost every... I mean, tons of this stuff are coming into the Earth, and we're doing nothing about it, to analyze it, to look for what might be the eventual outcome of such injections of biology and so on. So I think it is imperative that something happens. And I hope it's not a major pandemic that would drive us into some kind of state of realization that we've been following the wrong path.
Mm-hmm.
Coming back to we talked about Arthur C. Clarke, in one of, I think, his last book called Carbon-Based Bipeds, Greetings, Carbon-Based Bipeds is the title. He has projections for the future, and his projection for 2061 is that Halley's Comet returns, human beings would land on the comet and find it creeping with microorganisms and life.
Hmm.
So I think it'll happen. I personally think that the evidence is so powerful now that it'll happen before that, and people will be really forced to accept that we are creatures of the cosmos. And then it's also the sequel is that there has to be intelligence that is far in excess of human intelligence. I cannot believe that the experiment of intelligence here on the Earth, whether it came from Earth or from space, is at the end of the road. I think we are probably at the very beginning, and there has to be much more advanced life forms out there, and perhaps we would make contact with them. Perhaps they would come in spaceships and land on our planet. We haven't had hard evidence for that yet, but that would be fun.
I like your perspective. I think it's very open, and it's refreshing, actually. So the book is Cosmic Womb, The Seeding of Planet Earth. We've been speaking with Dr. Chandra Ramsey. He's the co-author with Robert Bavall of this fantastic book. I just found out it's now available on Amazon, and you can order it. And I believe you can actually get it now. It wasn't available last week. It's available this week. So those of you listening, check this book out. Dr. Ramsey, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. And this information is really an eye-opener, not only for me, but I think a lot of our listeners are really going to enjoy it.
Thank you, Cliff. Yeah, thank you. It's a great pleasure talking to you, and I hope our listeners would also enjoy the book and also enjoy listening to our interview.
I know they will. Thanks again.
Okay, that's it for today's show. Thank you for joining me this year. I hope you'll be back with me in 2018. Happy New Year's to you and your family, and blessings.
I listen to the wind of my soul. Where I'll end up, well, I think only God really knows. I've sat upon the setting sun, but never, 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 never. I never wanted water once, no, never, never, never. Listen to my words, but they fall far below. I let my music take me where my heart wants to go. I swam upon the devil's lake, but never, 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 never. I'll never make the same mistake. Never, never, never.